Good afternoon. It is 3:16, Wednesday, January 15th. This is the TDN Writers Room podcast. I am Joe Bianca, associate editor of the Thoroughbred Daily News.
I'm Bill Finley, and I got to tell you, I am shocked to find out that my Red Sox were cheating when they won the 2018 World Series.
Jonathan Green from DJ Sable, general manager, and for this show only, if I agree with Bill Finley, I will bang the garbage can once. If I disagree, I will bang it twice.
Very good.
Great. More baseball, just what I wanted here in the TDN Writers Room. Today's news slash week in review is sponsored by West Point Thoroughbreds. Owning a racehorse with West Point Thoroughbreds can be one of the most exciting experiences of your life. Partnerships offer the thrills and gratification of the sport of kings at a fraction of the investment required to purchase and maintain an entire horse on your own. Experience for yourself why West Point Thoroughbreds is the gold standard in racing partnerships. Visit our website, westpointtb.com. All right, so we're going to break, not breaking news, but we're going to respond to breaking news right off the top of the bat here. This is, you know, we've only had 15 minutes or so to look over this, but the Breeders' Cup released a pretty extensive report about Mongolian Groom and the protocols that were followed going into the Breeders' Cup. Obviously, the big story was him breaking down and eventually being put down. First of all, before we get into any of the details of it, I want to give a shout out to the Breeders' Cup in the interest of transparency here, because it is an extensive report from Dr. Larry Bramlage, and it really seems like they left no stone unturned in terms of trying to figure out why this happened. And I think the main conclusion is that there's a lot of factors that go in to these kind of breakdowns on the track. There's nothing really where you can add 1 + 1 and get the answer of why a horse broke down. There's always a bunch of other factors that go into it, sometimes mitigating factors. And it seems like the idea here was that there was soreness and there was a little bit of irregularity observed in Mongolian Groom, but the way Dr. Bramlage put it was that it was hard to differentiate between soreness that comes at the end of a long racing campaign and lameness. And I think that was basically what he found. And there were some protocols that I think he recommended be put in place. We're still going through it at this time. But the one thing I did notice is that when XBTV put up that workout video of Mongolian Groom before the Breeders' Cup, and everybody seemed on the internet looked at it and said, wow, this is a lame horse. How did they let this horse run? And then XBTV took down the video, which obviously lent more credence to that theory. He said that the Breeders' Cup officials didn't see that video, and he said that was regrettable, that should have been part of the evaluation. But the horse was subject to a lot more increased scrutiny. I think he was on a list of like 24 horses that had the highest level of scrutiny entered in the Breeders' Cup, and I think like 15 or so were scratched. So we're still looking through this, and I'm not an equine anatomy expert, so I can't comment on specifically what was done right or wrong here. All I can say is that this is at least the kind of transparency we want to see, and we don't see it a lot in racing, as we'll get to in another story later on.
Joe, I totally agree with you that it's great to see that there was so much transparency in this. And I'm just thumbing through this report myself now for the first time. And it's very detailed. It leaves no stone unturned. And you can see that they're not hiding anything. And especially in a year where the Kentucky Derby stewards, you know, kind of made fools out of themselves by disqualifying Maximum Security and then refusing to even speak to the media. It's really good to see this. I'm just still surprised, though, and that I still don't understand how so many vets could have looked at this horse and passed him to race. And now we're finding out, they're not saying anything in this report that he was terribly lame or had serious problems, but they are saying that there was a problem. And in hindsight, the horse should have been scratched. Here's the summary: it's hard to fault a process at a 99.6 accuracy rate. That's 99.6 with all the horses that started and didn't get hurt. But there were opportunities to remove Mongolian Groom from competition that were missed due to time constraints or process deficiencies that could be made more prominent. Very, very surprising. And it does sound like somebody dropped the ball.
No question about it. And having run a couple of horses in this year's Breeders' Cup, I can tell you as an owner that the scrutiny was extremely thick, for lack of a better term. There were seven different vets that looked over your horse over the course of the week. I know for the two-year-olds, you had to have them on the premises 5 days prior to their racing, or you were immediately disqualified from running. And, you know, there were multiple times where between veterinarians and other trainers and all of the, you know, the morning workouts being broadcasted live and on tape, that there were multiple opportunities to look at a horse and scratch a horse. I think that in any process, they're continually trying to get it better. And it seems like with, you know, with this 24, 25 page report, that's ultimately their goal, is that they're saying, you know, even though we were 99.6%, you know, accuracy or accurate, we always want to strive to be 100%. And obviously we're all trying to do that as an industry, and they're going to continue to make this process better. The thing that I question is, again, it's a 24 page report. We didn't have time to really go through it in great detail, but why have a maybe list? It seems like they had three lists. They had yes, definitely not, and a quote-unquote watch list is what they're calling it. To me, it's just like being half pregnant. Either you are or you aren't. Either you're going to, you know, the horse is okay to run or the horse ain't okay to run. And either way, you have to, you know, present it to all parties that are out there, that if we have a question that this horse isn't sound enough, then what's the protocol to either get him, you know, where it's unquestioned, or, you know, do you have time to do the necessary tests in order to be able to make sure that the horse can run? And if it's not, then let everyone involved, from the owner, the trainer, the jockey, all the way to the fans and the bettors, let them know well in advance that this horse is not eligible to run, not we're watching it.
Yeah. One of the interesting things I saw in the report was that the barn itself had concerns about his workout. He had a slow workout prior to the Breeders' Cup, and the trainer himself and the groom were thinking actually of passing on the Breeders' Cup themselves and pointing instead to the Saudi Cup. But then what happened was the exercise rider came back and said that the saddle had slipped during the workout. And he said that most likely led to the slow time. So it just seems like one of those things where it was a kind of a perfect storm that led this, I'm not going to say unsound, but at least red flagged horse to run. So, you know, a lot of this comes down to bad luck. But I just wanted to, in Dr. Bramlich's summary here, he said, in my opinion, the key opportunities for process improvement are to improve the quality of the on-track observations and to introduce the ability to jog horses in need of quote-unquote extra scrutiny in circles at some safe location on the backside of the racetrack. This should help separate the significantly lame horses from the horses that have routine soreness. It would also create the threshold for requesting radiographic or ultrasonographic imaging prior to clearance for competition for horses of concern. The advantageous use of video footage of horses training prior to the event as part of the routine veterinary examination should also help select horses for extra scrutiny. So right there, he's talking about the XBTV video. And that's an interesting point, the idea to have it a special area for horses to all do the same exercise in the presence of the veterinarians, whereas now it seems like they all do what the trainers want them to do. And some horses are galloping, some horses are breezing, some horses are just walking. They do different distances, they go different directions. So it's the kind of thing, especially in the lead up to Breeders' Cup week, that can be pretty chaotic in terms of trying to observe everything at once. So I think that's an interesting idea, is taking these at-risk horses and giving them a constant surface, distance, whatever you want to do to let the veterinarians compare apples to apples. So I think that's an interesting idea.
John, I agree with you about the, you know, half pregnant thing that you said. But again, looking at this and trying to look through it very carefully, it says there were 17 horses who competed that had comments that they were short, choppy, or stiff behind on the pre-race barn examination. 16 of those horses ran without incident, the 17th being Mongolian Groom. So obviously their standards for putting a horse on the maybe list probably not that difficult to get on that list if 17 horses made it onto that list. And I just don't think it would be practical to have scratched all 17 of them. But then again, this is all hindsight. And they say that is a 99.6 accuracy rate. The decision was wrong on only one horse, Mongolian Groom. And, you know, they're sort of patting themselves on the back a little bit here. Hey, you know, we got it right with all these horses. Well, no, you got to get it right 100%. You know, having one dead horse is not okay.
Especially when it comes up where it wasn't anything, you know, within the race. There wasn't any jostling amongst the horses that caused the injury. It wasn't like the horse, took a weird step because it was looking at the infield, or because, you know, the crowd noise at the top of the stretch, you know, made it hit the rail. I mean, this was really just a very straightforward race from that standpoint. Mm-hmm.
This week's news was sponsored by West Point Thoroughbreds. Joining a West Point Thoroughbreds partnership is one of the most affordable, smart, and fun ways for new owners to enjoy all the fun of being an insider in an entirely new world for a fraction of the cost. Check us out at westpointtb.com.
One of the other topics that I wanted to bring up was actually that parks reduced their takeout limits on their trifectas, superfectas, pick three, and pick four. And even though they didn't get a lot of fanfare, I think it's worth mentioning that they recognized, hey, they were taking 30% out and it was too high. So they went ahead and they talked to the trainers and they talked to other management within the organization. And they decided to lower takeout from 30% to 25% on most of those exotic bets. And the interesting thing about it is one of the key studies that they intimated was that Keeneland did it back in 2018. Keeneland actually announced that they would, at the time, decrease the percent they were taking out on win place show handles. From 17.5% to 16%, and on exactas and trifectas from 22% to 19%. Doesn't sound like a big percent difference, but what happened? Well, in October of that year, the fall meet had all kinds of records as far as total source bets. There was over $144 million bet. The previous year was an all-time high at $140 million. I'm rounding a little bit. So an increase of about 18%. And then last year, being this past October of 2019, with some warmer weather and even some better race cards, the amount that was bet increased by another 8.6%. And they being Keeneland, is pointing directly to this lower takeout as the impetus behind the higher amounts that are bet. So I want to give Parks Racing kudos and standing ovation for actually recognizing that if they lower takeout, it may increase the overall handle and betting that they find on hand.
I think it is worth noting that the Keeneland decreases came after they increased takeout. They increased takeout across the board, and then there was a huge backlash, and the horse players of North America boycotted. There was a big boycott. Churchill, when they did a similar thing, and Keeneland, to their credit, unlike Churchill, dropped some of the takeout rates back down, and I think that they were rewarded for that. It's a good thing. You said off the air, like, we beat up on these guys a lot, and especially in these mid-Atlantic tracks. And, you know, Parks is not the prettiest racetrack in the world. And I think a lot of it exists to have the casino on the grounds, and then it's the racetrack on the side. But yeah, thing is, when you're dropping it from 30 to 25%, 30% is absurd. There shouldn't be any 30% takeout rates in the country, but they do have 31% trifecta takeout rates at Penn National, and they had it at Parks previously. So I think there is still a lot of work to do for these tracks, but I agree that any track reducing takeout deserves to be applauded. And I think it doesn't make me want to bet Parks that much more, but I think you will see a bit of a handle increase because of it.
Well, yes, congratulations to Parks, and you can't fault them for lowering the takeout, but it's still way too high. I mean, 25% takeout on any gambling venture is ridiculous. And, you know, it's just no way to grow the sport. It's no way to attract handle. And, you know, make it 12%, then I'll get excited.
Yeah, I mean, there's still definitely a lot of work to do. And that's something that I think I've become more conscious of as a horse player. And that's kind of why we're going to get into this a little bit later. We're going to have a little handicapping discussion. But it's why I'm mostly a pick five better, because I think in terms of value, 15% pick five versus 25% pick four you really should go for that initial bet and then maybe work your way backwards if you don't have a feasible ticket. But yeah, you guys are both right. Like, it's a step in the right direction, but there's still a lot of work to be done in terms of getting to a competitive takeout rate with other sports. I mean, so in that vein, before the Mongolian groom thing came out, this was a very slow news week. And honestly, if we had gotten this release later, we probably could have done the whole show on Mongolian groom. But as it is, we wanted to do something a little more general this time, this week. And I wanted to talk about our handicapping strategies. We don't do a lot of horse player centric topics other than takeout raises or takeout decreases. But one of the things I wanted to talk about is kind of how you find long shots at the track, because You know, it's especially like if you're a pick five player or if you're a, any kind of exotics player, really, like trifectas or superfectas, the way you make money is to get one or two prices, and you can have a lot of other logical results in those sequences and still get paid. So I, like I said before, I start with a pick five because that's a 15% takeout. So I try to zero in on that, but sometimes it becomes a little bit too expensive, and then you can step back and do pick fours and pick threes. But again, like the takeout then becomes 10% higher. In terms of long shots, one of the things I've noticed in my years as a horse player, going on almost 20 years now playing the horses, is it's much easier for me, at least, to find prices in turf racing than it is in dirt racing. And I think part of that is owed to the fact that there are bigger fields in turf racing, so you have more options. There's more distribution in terms of the money. Another reason that I think that you can find value in turf races is I think a lot of it has to do with come home time, which is the final fraction, whether it's the last quarter mile, last 5/16ths, last 3/8ths. This is something that I really look for in the form and has really helped me out and made me some money along the way. Is in turf racing, as we know, it's basically a sprint. It's a quarter mile sprint. Dirt racing is much more labor intensive, and horses have to run hard for the entire way. So I think that's why you see these bunched up finishes in turf racing. You don't see as much in dirt racing. So that leads to come home time being very, very important. Whereas in dirt racing, there's very little variability, I think, between come home times. You know, I think you might find like a fifth of or two fifths of a second difference. In turf racing, you can really point to these horses who don't have great form, don't have great speed figures, but you can find these races where they came home in like under 30 seconds for 5/16ths or under 23 for a quarter mile. And I think that's really valuable, is to find those horses who might not have a ton of early speed, might not have great form, but are able to kick in with that late punch, because there's so much, it's so much more of a crapshoot in turf racing. So if you can isolate those horses at big prices that have those fast come home times, I think that's a valuable exercise.
No question about it. You bring up some very good points, Joe. And just in general, you know, I think you're correct as far as the turf racing having more value. Usually the races are a little more difficult to handicap. There's a lot of horses that are trying turf for the first or second time, so you don't really have a full gauge on just how what kind of talent they have on the grass. And finally, you know, certain trainers, i.e. Chad Brown, get overbet on the turf. And if it's just an average horse for him and there's other horses in there, it you know, opens up a lot of value or adds a lot of value. One of the things that I also look for in dirt racing more so than turf racing is horses that have improving buyers, horses that are getting stronger, that are getting faster, and therefore getting better numbers as time goes on. And the other thing is, you know, I look a lot towards breeding. And I'm looking at sire power, of course, but also on the female side. And we're going to talk later on about some of the impressive maiden winners down at Gulfstream. But there was a filly that was a daughter of Dame Dorothy that Bobby Flay owns that was a homebred of his. Dame Dorothy was a phenomenal runner in herself. She was a first-time starter, and she won like a champion. And that horse should have been bet all day long, especially because three-quarters of the horses in the race, if not more, had never run before. So you have to be very conscious of breeding and not just, you know, what did the horses sell for at the yearling or two-year-old sales.
Tying into that point is going back to turf racing. I think that's another way that you can find value is, you know, if a horse has run once or twice on the dirt and has zero buyers, I mean, that's really irrelevant in terms of how the horse is going to perform on turf. So you can dig deep and you can find these turf families, and people will oftentimes write these horses off if they don't have good dirt form. You can might as well draw a line through it with some of these horses. And that's what I try to do, is if I have an idea of a lightly raced horse getting on turf for the first time, I don't even think about the dirt form. Honestly, I hope it's worse so I get a better price. And I think there are a lot of people that don't think like that. They want to see at least some semblance of talent on dirt first, whereas a lot of times it doesn't even really matter. And I think especially going dirt to turf, it happens occasionally turf to dirt. Like there are certain sires that I will look for, like Union Rags, for example, horses that really just can't sire a turf runner to save their lives. Those horses I'll look at when they get on dirt, but especially dirt to turf. I've seen so many horses that cannot stand up on dirt will become completely new animals on turf. And I think that's another way that you can find value. And just before I get to Bill, another thing, and you were talking about improving buyer speed figures. The one I like to see is horses that improve first time against winners, because I think that is that's a scenario where a lot of horses either stay flat or take a step back because the competition increases so much. So I really love to see horses that, you know, it doesn't really matter what level or what kind of figure they ran. I'd love to see horses after they break their maiden and they step into winning company, then improve, because it usually means that there's further improvement down the line.
Joe, when you're playing the pick five, you were looking for value, which of course is what all horse players should do. And the one thing I would add to that is that I find in these horizontal bets that if you can somehow get a big favorite beaten in what that the value goes up astronomically, because so many people are, you know, don't have big bankrolls and want to try to hit this with a $28 ticket or something like that. And you take an even money shot, it'll be singled on 80% of the tickets, where an even money shot only takes up about 40% of the pool in the win, place, and show wagering. So you still have to be right. You have to get these horses to not win. But if you can ever get that Chad Brown at 4-5 in one of these legs in a pick five or something, and you really think the horse is vulnerable and be right about it, then you can definitely add tremendous value to the ticket. You know, you look at sometimes you can look at the parlay. You know, if you bet $2 to win on every one of the horses and kept parlaying it all the way along, and every once in a while you'll get one of these pick fives or something that is just, you know, double the parlay or something like that. It's usually because some big favorite gets knocked out.
Yeah, and I never understand people who just bet connections. Maybe it's more casual bettors, but I never understood the idea that you look at a horse and it's trained by Chad Brown or Ty Pletcher, I'm going to bet this horse irrespective of what the form is or what the pedigree is. I never understood that. So it's kind of a delicate dance, you know, especially when you have these high powered barns, because a lot of times they can be relied on for singles, because you do need singles along the way in order to keep costs down. But then there are horses that are vulnerable. So it's about trying to pick that horse that's vulnerable to try to beat, and then pick the other horse that you think lays over the field. And yeah, maybe a little bit over bet because of the barn. But I always go back to this example, but back when Jamie Ness was at Tampa Bay Downs and was just winning everything and was winning at like 40%, I always had really good success with him because I felt like every horse would get bet the same way, and they didn't have the same odds of winning. So I used to do a pretty good job of finding which ones were the true layovers and which ones were overbet just because of the name of the trainer. And it's easier said than done, but I think that's one of the key questions in terms of going into these multi-race sequences. Don't just take the horse. Don't just assume the horse is going to win because he's trained by so-and-so. He has to have the form. He has to have the right setup. And so I think that's something to look at.
You know, I definitely agree with you. But these guys like the Chad Browns of the world, the high percentage trainers, just drive you crazy. And I don't remember the name of the horse off the top of my head. Maybe one of you guys would. But Chad Brown won the Marshall's River last weekend at Gulfstream, but the horse had no chance.
Yeah.
None whatsoever.
That was my homebred, Magic Star.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, of course, the breeding was fantastic.
Yeah, of course, exactly.
Had no numbers, had run in one allowance race and wasn't even competitive. Now was going in against graded stakes horses and won. It's like, whoa. You know, we're not worthy. He's the greatest.
Yeah. And I don't have the form in front of me, but I felt like that horse had a good come home time in the previous race. But yeah, I mean, that horse was like, what, 5-2? It's just
if you were trained by Al Schlebotnik, it would have been 15-1. That's
right.
My point.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, somebody tweeted out that I thought it was very funny. They said, if the horse was trained by Brad Chown, it would be 20-1. And you know, instead of Chad Brown.
Yeah. Yeah.
See how they did that?
Oh, okay.
We got it. We got it. But yeah, I mean, it happens the other way too, where there will be a horse like trained by David Donk, who is a good trainer, but not a big name trainer, will win it 4-1. Whereas if the horse was trained by Todd Pletcher, it was 7-5. So I think people focus on human connections too much when they bet horses, and especially in the win pool.
Yeah, and the last thing I'll throw out there, just in the 30 plus years that I've been watching racing, is that if you can find a horse that was bet heavily first time out and runs off the board and then is coming back basically in the same race, you know, they're keeping it in main special weight race, maybe they're changing the distance, maybe they're changing the surface, if there was a lot of money bet on them the first time out and the second time out, and the horse ran up this track, and then the second time out the horse is in against basically the same group or the same level, I would, you know, take a second look at that type of horse, because you just can't write off a horse based on the on its first race. You really can't. You got to give it another chance, especially if there was a lot of momentum going into the race.
Yeah, and you got to handicap the board too. Like, especially during the summer when these two-year-old races happen, you really got to figure out who's getting bet and who isn't. And it's not always significant, but I think a lot of times it is, especially in the bigger pool races at Saratoga. That's kind of the opposite of the whole wedding funeral thing. When a horse wins at 50-1 and you didn't bet it, it's the phrase is, and Andy Serling uses this a lot, is you weren't there for the wedding. Don't be there for the funeral when the horse comes back and loses at 6-5, because that happens a lot too. And that's something that I think people kind of try to overcompensate if they miss the horse the first time and then the horse will be overbet the second time. I always try to steer clear of those situations because they never seem to work out.
Yeah, they don't make movies about funeral crashing, only wedding crashing. So just, exactly. You know, there's obviously a reason for that.
So those are our handicapping thoughts for the day. I think this is something that we're going to try to do a little bit more of as time goes on, especially in these drier winter months in terms of news. So I think that's something that we're going to broach a little bit more going forward, because it is such a big part of horse racing. It is a big part of my life, at least as a fan, is playing the horses and trying to make money. So I think that's something we're going to do a little bit more going forward. And I think, you know, we all have some fairly good ideas, and we're always open to feedback and stuff that you guys think about as well. So we'll move on now to a little bit of news. We're not going to spend too much time on it because it is old news technically. But the other day, Mick Ruiz filed a petition against the CHRB for the non-DQ of Justify in the 2018 Santa Anita Derby. And this was something that came out from Joe Drape in the New York Times last year about Justify failing a drug test for scopolamine. And it turned out, I guess, that it was environmental contamination.
It was a trace amount.
Yeah, and it was a trace amount. But it kind of stunk the way that they handled it. And it seemed like it was brushed under the rug, at least somewhat, because it was such a big name horse. And I think that's kind of what Mick Ruiz and his lawyer, Daryl Viena, ex-trainer, are getting at in this petition. And it's just, I don't know, there can't be separate rules for separate people in horse racing. And I think that we've touched on it a lot in terms of like trainers who are very obviously cheating, being able to stay at these tracks. And I hope that this at least brings to light maybe some protocol issues with the CHRB in terms of how they handled it, because it was a Triple Crown winner. So, and we'll see if it goes anywhere, but I do think it's an interesting idea from Mick Ruiz, you know, even after all this time. I know it's a little hypocritical because I always kill Gary West for staying in the news all year long, and he's still bringing this up from 2018. But I do think he has a legitimate gripe here in terms of the way it was handled.
Yeah, when I look at these things, 99% of the time you think, like we've said with the Gary West situation, this is just a waste of everybody's time. This is not going anywhere. I think the guy has a pretty good lawsuit on his hands. And, you know, if it gets to the courts, they'll have to try to figure out whether or not under the CHRB rules, the horse should have been disqualified. It looks like the CHRB just said, okay, accidental contamination, no harm, no foul. We're not going to do anything about it. But be that as it may, what were the rules at that point? And, you know, a lot of people have said that the rule in place said, you know, even if it was a nickel and dime suspension for something that was, again, environmental contamination, they had to do it. I just wonder, though, where's the money going to come from? So he would have got, I guess, $200,000 for finishing second, would have got $600,000 for winning. So he's going to probably sue for $400,000. That money is already in Justify's account and been spent. CHRB doesn't have $400,000, I'm sure, you know, to just take out of their pockets to pay the guy. So that'll be an interesting part of it as well.
Mm-hmm. And not only that, but it does, you know, set out additional ripple effects or butterfly effect, in the sense that here's a horse, Justify, didn't run as a two-year-old, ran as a three-year-old, won that graded stake race in order to get enough points to be eligible to run at the Kentucky Derby. If he gets disqualified from the Santa Anita win, he doesn't have any points. So he can't run in the Derby. So then he doesn't win the Derby. He doesn't win the Triple Crown, and kind of blah, 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 you know, and then a tsunami occurs in Japan. But basically, like, that's what is going to be the wake of all this, which I think is the primary reason why the CHRB kind of went, we're not going to do with anything, any of this, because if that happens, then Santa Anita Derby may lose its grade one status, because the winner of the Kentucky Derby that earned points for the Kentucky Derby, then it affects our grading, our graded rating, and so on and so on and so on. So I think they were just hoping that, as you mentioned before, it was no harm, no foul, and let's keep going on our merry way.
Yeah, and they've managed to escape that along with Oaklawn. You know, they had the aqueduct, the Wood Memorial downgraded, the Bluegrass downgraded. I feel like that's the way things are going. But so far, they and Oaklawn have been able to keep their grade one status for those derby preps. I just wanted to pull up from the Dan Ross story about this. It says the CHRB didn't file a complaint after the failed drug test, and choosing instead to dismiss Justify's positive in a closed-door session in August of 2018. Let me stop you right there. Closed door session.
That's transparent.
Is the first red flag, you know, especially now that they have all these CHRB meetings where they're letting the PETA people come in and yell at them. But this one, they had to keep behind closed doors. So that's strike one right there.
That's enough right there. I mean, just the fact that there was the lack of transparency, you know, and again, this is all pre PETA. And you know, people talk about security all pre 9/11. You know, we didn't ever do this before 9/11, never did this before 9/11. Well, you know, it seems like that with everything that's transpired in 2019, it's making things, at least in a positive way, more transparent and more accessible. And, you know, hopefully you avoid situations like this down the road.
So this is a quote from Daryl Vienos, Mick Ruiz's attorney. He said there was another way to handle this, and it was simply for the CHRB to do what it normally does and follow its own procedures, to file a complaint and to have a hearing. If at the hearing, Rick Arthur or anyone wanted to present evidence that this was a case of environmental contamination, they could have exonerated Mr. Baffert, and that would have still left the issue of redistribution of purse. That's what normally happens in almost every case. And it says towards the end of the year, Ruiz requested the CHRB to conduct a public hearing into the board's handling of the case. The board denied Ruiz's request, and he says, why was this case handled differently? If this was the other way around, if Mick Ruiz had the winning horse and it tested positive, do you think this would have happened? Because I don't. I tend to agree with them on that, and especially since the CHRB told the TDN it has no comment. So this is, obviously, like, I know I'm not privy to these conversations. It could be a completely legitimate decision, but we were talking about before, about the Breeders' Cup being forthright and transparent about all the procedures and everything that led into Mongolian Groom, and then having a post-mortem investigation and a 25-page report in terms of what could have been done better. And I think a lot of entities in racing don't ever want to admit there's anything they could have done better. And there's a transparency issue here. And I again, without knowing the specifics, I think this is something that should have been more public and more thoroughly investigated. And I think McRuey's got a little bit of a case here.
I thought Saturday's card at Gulfstream was fascinating, that there were four maiden special weight races for three-year-old males and also an allowance race for three-year-old males, first level allowance. And this time of year at Gulfstream, just like you get at Saratoga and Del Mar, you know there's going to be horses just bred to the teeth, very expensive horses, and somebody out of these races is going to be able to run, because if you beat that level of competition, you got to be good. But it brought up to mind, if anyone who won on Saturday's card, and the horse that I liked the most, and I wrote about this, was Violent City, because he won despite the fact that Ian Wilkes hasn't won with a first-time starter since the 1800s. So that horse has to improve. But can a horse go from breaking its maiden in January to winning the Kentucky Derby? And before Justify came along, we would have said, no, it's just not going to happen. There was all that, you know, stuff about no horse since Apollo in 1882. So I guess my question is, did Justify rewrite the rules, or was he just an exception to the rules because he was a freak with or without scopolamine?
I will say that I think the contrast between horses entering the Derby having two-year-old racing and entering the Derby having only three-year-old racing, in terms of number of starts, is a lot smaller than it used to be. I think it used to be the case where if you started as a two-year-old, you had 15, 16 starts coming into the Derby, and then maybe if you started as a three-year-old, you had five or six. Now, if you start in January, you still got time for three or four races, and even the horses that started as two-year-olds, what do they have, five or six, maybe seven? So I think the foundation difference between horses that start as two-year-olds and as three-year-olds is not necessarily as wide as it used to be. And I think Justify was a special horse and maybe an exception to the rule, but I think you will see more exceptions as time goes on and horses race less and less, unfortunately.
No question about it. And the other thing that you have to be conscious of is that about, you know, a few years ago, the rules changed as far as what was your eligibility to get into the Kentucky Derby. It used to always be based on earnings. And if you earned the most, therefore you earned a spot of the top 20 in the Kentucky Derby. And then a few years ago, they changed it to a point system with all these races that are the Derby preps that have assigned points. Well, in the past 4 years, the number of points that you need at a minimum to get in is 40 points. So, you know, I'm managing a stable and I'm trying to figure out if I should run in the Wingfield or the Private Terms or the Gotham, for example. Well, two of those three races, you know, which of these doesn't belong? Okay. Two of those three races don't have points to them. And I think even, you know, Willis was mentioning before, one of the reasons why he picked the Fairgrounds race for his two horses was because it was a point-related race. Well, if 40 points is the minimum, then all you need to do is win one of the 50-point preps that are coming up. And there's multiple. That's the Fountain of Youth. That's the Risen Star. That's the Tampa Bay Derby. There's San Felipe. There's a whole host of races that you know, have a 50-point win total right there. And then if you finish second in Louisiana Derby, the UAE Derby, the Florida Derby, the Wood Memorial, there's a dozen races also that if you finish second, you're going to have enough points historically to get in. So it's not a matter of needing to have 5, 6, 7 races under your belt to earn enough money to get into the races. Now you just need the place in one of these races, and you can very easily do that. Not easily in the sense because the competition stuff, but it's easier to do that than to have to grind through a half a dozen preps to earn enough money and still not know if you're going to get in.
Yeah, and it speaks to the way the horses are campaigned, where it used to be you raced horses into shape, you raced horses into form, whereas now, especially with three-year-olds, you can pick these little spots. And obviously, they're still going to be building form and building endurance and bottom as they go on, but I think there's more targeted, you know, choosing of spots now than there used to be, where it used to be, this is a prep race for this, this is a prep race for that, this is a starting point, this is this and that. There is still some of that, but I think now every race has forethought behind it. The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. With more than 500 clients in the horse business, they were bred to save you money. For more information on how they can help you, visit www.greenco.com. So for this week's Green Group Guest of the Week, we welcome in Mr. Willis Horton, prominent owner and breeder in thoroughbred racing, who has a couple of horses in this Saturday's LeCompte Stakes. Welcome to the show, Willis.
Well, thank you. Proud to be here.
All right. So let me just go through these two horses real quick in the LeCompte. I know you have a couple others. The first one is Silver State, co-owned with Winchell Thoroughbreds, who dead-heated for the victory in his debut and then missed by a nose second out at Churchill. And then the other one is Halo again, Spitestown Colt, who won by open lengths first out at Churchill Downs and then also went north of the border and took the Coronation Futurity at Woodbine. So how do you feel about both of those horses? Do you think one of them is a little bit ahead of the other one at this point? What do you think about them going forward?
Well, I feel real good about both of them and with their breeding and everything and all, and then what they've already showed. I think they've still got improvement left in them. Tally feel a little better, stronger, I guess, on the Halo again. Mm. When you get down to Silver State, you know, he's out of Hardspun, and Hardspun has really gotten hot in 19. And so you never know, you know, we're really hoping that we've got one of the good Hardspuns. And if we have, well, we'll be in good shape going, looking forward to the Kentucky Derby.
Have you looked at the race at all? Are there any horses that you're looking at as competition specifically?
Yes, I've looked at it. There's one horse, I think he's 13th or 14th in Blasting. I don't have it in front of me, but he's a pretty nice horse, looks like.
You talking about Sycamore Run? Sycamore Run is in the 13 hole to Joe Sharp horse.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Yes. Bill?
Yeah. Good afternoon, Willis, and thanks for joining us. Back to your two horses in the Lecompte Stakes. I want to start with Halo again. That this is an Ontario bred and has also won a stakes race at Woodbine. Could this horse ultimately wind up in the Queen's Plate instead of the Kentucky Derby?
It's good possibility. You know, he'll try to separate the two horses after this race, it's a good chance that we could wind up in the Queen's Plate.
Okay. And you just told my compadre, Joe, a few minutes ago that you kind of like Halo again a little bit more than Silver State, which goes against the almighty buyer figure. Silver State has a couple of 82s, and Halo again, his top number is a 72, 57 when he broke his maiden at Churchill in October. So could you elaborate on that? Why is Halo again maybe a little bit ahead of Silver State in your book?
Well, if you go back and look at the races, he was running real green. You know, I just think he'll get his mind together and do what he's supposed to do.
Mr. Horton, it's Jonathan Green from DJ Stable, and I also manage a racing stable up here in the Northeast. And I'm always curious when I look at other successful ventures like yours with Winchell. Who is in the process that is picking the horses out for you as yearlings? Who's shortlisting them? Because obviously it's difficult to get a stake winner out of the September sale, and you were able to do it with two strikes with both Halo again and Silver State. So if you can, flesh out for us the process of how you go about buying these young colts as yearlings and who's involved.
Well, first of all, they've got to meet the approval of both my partner and I, and then we've got other people that's working with us that does a lot of legwork on the thing.
Okay, is it with an agent that's shortlisting, or a veterinarian, or is it your trainers that, you know, in this case, Steve, that's going down to the sales and presenting you with a shortlist?
Well, Steve is always there, too. And so he's involved in the going over the short list of everybody and all of us getting together and approving or disapproving of each horse that got on the short list.
Very good. And my follow-up question to you is, you know, you have two horses in this race. There are certainly a number of Kentucky Derby preps all up and down the country right now. Is there a reason why they both landed in this particular race? Were there other races that, you know, that you were considering? You know, obviously the Canadian bred wouldn't be running at Woodbine because Woodbine's closed right now. But any reason why either of them didn't end up in Florida or in Oakland?
Well, in Oakland, of course, they got the Smarty Jones, which it don't have any points, Derby points. And the main reason is the cops got Derby points for the horses.
And Willis, sort of a follow-up on what John was asking you, how long have you been affiliated with Winchell Thoroughbreds? How long have you guys been partners? And talk about, if you would, the relationship with Ron Winchell and his family.
I've been partners with him for 4 years. We have a very good relationship. We never argue or fuss about anything, and we're very easy to work with and try to get the right things done.
All right, Willis, this is Joe Bianca again. I wanted to take us back a little bit, because people might not know this, but you were involved in the controversial Kentucky Derby disqualification last year because Maximum Security came out and interfered with your long-range Toddy and then eventually got placed behind that horse. Can you take us back and recall what you were thinking at that time and whether or not you thought the horse deserved to come down and what you thought of that whole mess?
I never did think the horse should have come down because he was the best horse, I think, but at the same time, I had a horse right there with him, and he got the worst end of the whole deal, and in fact, it took him out of the race and the rest of the summer most. But he's back in training now and doing good, and we'll see what he does this year.
Well, let's back to long range toddy. And after the Kentucky Derby, Steve Asmussen picked sort of the B Derby route, Ohio Derby, Indiana Derby, Oklahoma Derby. And he didn't run all that well in any of those races. He was third in the Ohio Derby. Do you think in hindsight, the incident in the Derby kind of messed him up, so to speak, a little bit? Did it cause him to maybe go off form?
Well, he got hit from both sides. And when it all said and done, he had bone soreness, and that's the reason we took him off the track and give him time to heal on that. And that was the main issue right there.
All right, Willis, that's all we got for you. Thanks so much for the time, and good luck this weekend in the LeCompte.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. As the Green Group Guest of the Week, Willis Horton will receive a free one-hour tax consultation. The Green Group, bred to save you money. For more information on how they can help you, visit www.greenco.com. All right, so that's it for this week. We ended up talking about a lot more and a lot longer than we thought we would. I want to thank Bill Finley and John Green, as well as our Green Group Guest of the Week, Willis Horton, and we will see you next week.